Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. So the COP28 summit is underway in Dubai. There is a considerable Canadian delegation, including a number of individuals representing Alberta at this climate summit. And it comes at an interesting moment, obviously, as we really seem to be in the midst of a transition here. But how long is that transition going to take? What is it going to look like in the meantime? You know, as we find better ways of making fossil fuel development more efficient, technology to help reduce emissions, what does it mean for oil and gas? And in particular, what does it mean for everybody who works in these industries, whose livelihood depends on all of this, right? There's a lot of uncertainty as to what it's going to mean in the years ahead. And it could potentially be a difficult transition, but maybe that needs to be a big focus. Is what that looks like and what it means to those whose lives are impacted by that. So there has been a lot of conversation around these issues. And like I say, it's kind of a pivotal moment, a bit of a crossroads we're at, if you will. And that's the focus of the new documentary that our next guest was involved in. In fact, is going to be screened, presented to an audience of thousands at COP28 in Dubai. The documentary is called Without Leaving Anyone Behind. It's more than just a documentary. It brings the global community together through thoughtful conversation on energy transition. You can read more at withoutleavinganyonebehind.com. Joining us on the line to talk more about these issues, one of the driving forces behind this documentary, Harry Vredenburg is a faculty professor, strategy and sustainability, the Haskayne School of Business at the U of C here in Calgary. Harry, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So first of all, give us a bit of the background on this project and you know, what was the spark for all of this to begin with?
Well, spark for all of this, I've been working at this not just for a year or two, but for decades. That's what the research I do as a professor, and that's the kind of courses that I've been teaching in our MBA program at the business school, as well as at the School of Public Policy. And it was during the pandemic that I was working on writing a book, and I got thinking about, you know, we need to reach out to a broader audience, because one thing that was bothering me was how polarized this whole discussion of energy transition has become.
Yeah.
And secondly, what was bothering me is how provincial or how localized the discussion has become without taking a broader global perspective. So I reached out to my friend Sylvester Ndumbi, who's a filmmaker. I'd been in one of his earlier films some 7-8 years earlier. And we got talking and said, well, you know, let's do a documentary film. And I've spent most of my career writing academic scholarly papers. I've got 60 or 70 of them. I've got close to 10,000 citations in the academic literature, but most people have never read any of this stuff. So the idea here was to let's get some of this stuff out in the open to a broader audience.
Right. So what was the process then in pulling all of this together and telling these stories and going around the world to gather these stories?
Yeah, and we literally did go around the world. I like to say we went from Honolulu to London, from Nairobi, Kenya, to Port of Spain, Trinidad and Tobago, from Harvard University to Oxford University, and from St. Robert, Saskatchewan, to Squamish, British Columbia. So we traveled around to all these places. They're all people that I had already been in contact with. Many of them I had interviewed for research projects. Others are former students. Many people have come from around the world to the University of Calgary to get graduate degrees in energy, whether they're MBAs or MSc degrees. And so I reached out to all of them, all the people I already knew. And then we traveled with a small crew and partnered up with local crews in each of the locations we went to get this broader perspective of what the energy transition might look like, and also how real is climate change itself? Is that being felt?
Right. So it's interesting because we've got competing issues here. The climate change is a challenge, obviously, but when you talk about workers and you talk about people's livelihoods, we can't ignore that either, right? So where is the balance?
And I think that you nailed it there. That's exactly what the issue is. And sometimes in Alberta, it's harder to see both sides at the same time. But one of my favorite interviews in the film is an interview I did with the energy minister of the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Trinidad and Tobago, in some ways, is kind of like Alberta. It's very heavily focused on oil and gas and petrochemicals. But they're also an island state, a twin island state in the Caribbean. And as the energy minister himself acknowledges, when he walks to work every day, he sees that the sea is coming up higher. They're regularly having flooding. We go in Trinidad to a place where villagers who aren't very well off, whose homes have been washed into the sea. And so in countries like that, it's very apparent that this is a challenge, a dual challenge. On the one hand, climate change is very real. It has impacts. And on the other hand, we have our livelihoods. 80% of the foreign exchange in the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago comes from oil and gas and petrochemicals. So they can't exactly shut down the industry and say, oh, well, let's all go back to the village and turn our back on all this wealth, because global markets for fossil fuels are still there.
So where does technology come into play? And what did this journey tell you about, you know, the deployability at scale of this kind of technology, or maybe how much further we need to go?
Yeah, no, exactly. And one of the things that I find sometimes frustrating is that when you see the debates, it's all or nothing. Everybody's the same. A common one that we hear is we need to, as quickly as possible, shut down the fossil fuel industry, the oil and gas industry, and we all need to switch to renewables.
Right.
Renewables are going to be a critical part of this energy change, but it depends on where you are. Renewables works great. We spend time in Hawaii, particularly the island of Kauai, where within a few years they're going to be 100% renewable, mostly solar, because they have endangered birds. They don't do much wind there. And energy storage, that is battery energy storage, pumped energy storage. So we look at what that looks like. That's in a small place like that, where they don't have to compete with inexpensive natural gas or coal or oil. But it also works in Alberta. We spend time looking at renewables in Alberta, where it's become quite competitive. And until recently, Alberta was the fastest growing jurisdiction in Canada in terms of renewables and energy storage. But what's also very relevant is how do people make their living? And again, back to Trinidad and Tobago, or we spend time in East Africa and Kenya as well. One of my former students is in the film. East Africa has just invested the last 10, 15 years into infrastructure for developing very attractive oil and gas resources that they have there. Mm-hmm. And they've trained people. A number of them have come to Calgary to be educated at the MBA level. So they've got this human and physical infrastructure. And to be told now, you've got to shut this all down, again, go back to the village, is not going to happen. So what's really, in my view, going to mean what this energy transition is going to mean is technology and policy are critical. So there are a number of technologies. Renewables is developing very quickly, lots of prospects there, but it's going to be a mix with other things as well. We're still going to see fossil fuels for a number of years yet, but we have to find ways to decarbonize the fossil fuels and to switch to other fuels which are by themselves decarbonized. So, for example, hydrogen is critically important. Hydrogen with carbon capture, known as blue hydrogen, is very important right now, and it's something that we do already in Alberta. And over time, that's going to switch, in my view, to green hydrogen. That is hydrogen produced from renewables, from hydro, from solar, from wind. So this is all this part of this transition. And a place like Alberta plays a role in that. It's a similar role to what Alberta has played historically. A lot of the new technologies in the energy space have come out of Alberta and out of Texas, but in many of them out of Alberta. Yeah. Directional drilling, fracturing, rock fracturing, fracking. Those have all come out of here and then have been disseminated around the world, either through consultancy, technical consultancy, technical transfer, or direct foreign investment by Canadian companies in different places in the world. And in my view, that is the future of a place like Alberta, to play that leading role in the world of being an energy developer, which then can be shared with places in the world, particularly those in the developing countries of what's known as the Global South. That's the Africa, the Caribbean, the South Americas, the Asias.
I guess part of the question becomes, you know, how quickly can we do all of this? And that's where you run into a lot of disagreement, that it needs to happen sooner rather than later. And we really need to push to make this happen. Others who say, OK, let's be careful and take our time with this and make sure we do it right. I don't know if there is necessarily a right answer to that question. But what does the timeline look like, do you think?
Yeah, I think timing is important. We need to move fairly quickly. We've been quite slow to get going on this. We probably should have been starting this 10, 20 years ago, but we didn't, yeah. And that's reality. So we do need to move fairly quickly, but we mustn't hurry as well, because the world, you know, is prosperous in many places because of fossil fuels, because of oil and gas. Places in the world like Africa are stepping up to this level right now. They can't turn back. So we have to find ways of moving forward that is not going to dispossess people from prosperity. And that's what's not leaving anyone behind. And so the actual timing, it's hard to say. We're all talking 2050, net zero by 2050. But at the same time, with technology development, there are sometimes step changes. There's sometimes things that suddenly make everything change, like solar energy, power. I remember teaching classes not long ago, 7-8 years ago, it was just not economic. It just wasn't happening. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, the cost of solar-generated power came down by 90%. And that's changed the whole renewable energy industry. I suspect we'll find similar things with carbon capture and storage, other technologies and other, you know, we in the film, we talk about some of the very new technologies as well, but something else that came out of Alberta is something called direct air capture. And it's direct air capture of CO2, which can then be put back into the ground from whence it came, or can be turned into synthetic fuel. So that can be used in cars and trucks as they are existing today, as they're engineered today. Not a new electric car, but cars that you have right now could be fueled by synthetic fuel from direct air capture. So we explore all those things in the film. And how long is that going to take? I don't think, you know, with one or two major sort of technology leaps, we could get there quicker, but it may take couple of decades as well.
Yeah. Well, and I want to ask for partly about the reaction so far to the film, but also, you know, the fact that it will be shown at COP28 and what you hope comes from that, because I think the World Petroleum Congress, it was screened at and some other venues too, but, you know, it's a big audience at COP28.
Yes, and actually I find it kind of nice and rewarding that we were both at the World Petroleum Congress and now at COP28, the big climate conference in Dubai. The response has been very positive. And again, what we're trying to do here is to bridge that polarization that we've seen. And I think we're helping people see things in a little bit more globally and a little bit more less polarized, shall we say. And I think that it's been very positive. We've also screened at film festivals. We were at the Calgary International Film Festival. We're currently, all of the month of December, we're at the British Columbia Environmental Film Festival, which also has a streaming component, so you can watch it on the British Columbia in Environmental Film Festival all this month. And we've also done screenings at universities. We've done in-house things at various companies. And the response has been very positive. And I think what people find is that it's refreshing, that it's a different kind of perspective from what they've heard. Because yeah. What they've heard is sort of right, left, polarized, whatever. And that's not what we're about. And it's very much a global perspective. Yeah. I'm also working with a brilliant filmmaker, Sylvester Ndombi, is African-Canadian, originally from Africa. He was born in Congo, spent his childhood in southern Africa and came to Canada as a teenager, and has a studio here in town. And people are sometimes surprised that this is coming out of Calgary, but we indeed are.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating project, an important one at that as well. WithoutLeavingAnyoneBehind.com is the website, much more there. But Harry, thank you so much for making some time for us here today. Really appreciate this.
Okay, thanks very much to you.
Back. Well, yeah, we've been using April Wine's songs as our return music through the day, marking the passing of Miles Goodwin. singer-songwriter, one of the founders of the band April Wine, died yesterday at the age of 75. So it's really sad news from the world of music. And just hearing all these different songs and some of the big hits, and you see what a diverse band they were. It came from some of the different perspectives of the members on music. Right, so a really unique, set of songs that the band had and albums over the years. But they were remarkably successful. Over 10 million records sold, inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame in 2010. They came together in 1969, really kind of broke through in 1972. They became the first Canadian band to sell more than 100,000 albums in Canada. And they had some breakthrough success in the U.S. as well. Now, earlier this year, Miles Goodwin, in fact, announced that he was going to step away from performing and touring with the band. And we had an opportunity to speak with him at the time. And one of the things he talked about was kind of the longevity of the band and its music, that support from the fans is still there after all these years.
Oh, well, that's really easy. That's radio has been very good to April Wine, and they continue to be good to April Wine. Music, April Wine's music is played everywhere in Canada all year round, played in a lot of parts of the United States still. Mm-hmm. At classic rock now, of course, is not in the top 40 or anything, but current top 40. But just classic radio and radio, and thanks to them, the continued play, people, three generations really are into the songs that they hear on the radio, and even the young people that I see now, very young people, that love April Wine, they know the words and all the rest of it. You see them singing along and you say, geez, they're only like 17 or 15 or something like that. It's crazy. And they just love the music, and that's because they hear it on the radio, they heard it from their parents. April Wine continues to be popular.
Yeah, they certainly do. And so an opportunity to reflect on the impact they had. And they were really pioneers in a lot of ways when it came to Canadian rock and what is now referred to as the classic rock era. Music journalist and publicist Eric Alper was, Miles' publicist. You can read more at his website, thatericalper.com, but joins us on the line here this afternoon. Eric, again, as mentioned, obviously really, really sad news, but we appreciate you making some time for us here today.
Always happy to talk to you.
Talking about, the legacy and the impact of April Wine, not just their success in Canada, but as mentioned, just kind of how in a lot of ways that they were pioneers. Just talk a bit about the influence and the impact they had.
Yeah, I think in order to answer that, I think, everybody has to go back to Nova Scotia. And in the late 60s, where this is even before CanCon and the Canadian government kind of, forced radio stations against their will, for the most part, to play Canadian songs. It wasn't easy back then to get radio on board with this, because the music industry and radio were so fine with bringing in worldwide talent and letting the audience decide. But, when you're Miles Goodwin and you start a band with your friends and two brothers and then their cousin in David and Richie Henman and then their cousin Jim, before MTV, before Much Music, before TikTok, the only way to do it was to play live, and you had to go from being awful to being great. Yeah. And winning a fan over one person at a time. And that's essentially what they did, playing every single high school, every single venue and arena. And looking at social media in the last 24 hours, it seemed like they played a lot of high schools, because people were remembering, the fact that they played their cafeteria before that they broke it big with You Could Be a Lady back in 1972. And that's when the record label started calling and the gig started getting better and better, opening up for Ike and Tina Turner and Badfinger and Stevie Wonder, and then having kind of hit after hit after hit after that. But there were the ups and then the downs of the regular rock and roll band that weren't really supposed to survive longer than 10 years. But, here we are talking about April Wine and their success, and there's still millions of streams on Spotify and millions of views on YouTube all these years later.
Yeah, how do you explain that longevity?
Time apart,
Yeah.
And really great songs, and not necessarily in that order. You know, the songs that Miles Goodwin wrote, everything from Just Between You and Me and Sign of the Gypsy Queen and Roller, there are songs that still hold up as just classic rock and roll, hummable songs that are easily so memorable. Mm-hmm. But it was also Miles's voice, too. You know, he looked like your average standard rock and roll dude in the 1970s wearing, you know, an open shirt and long hair and frizz and all of that stuff. But the voice attracted the attention. I think that it didn't sound like the way that he looked. There was a tinge of kind of being authentic and sensitive. And that's what Miles loved about writing songs. You know, April Wine was inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, and they were also inducted recently, like last month, into Canada's Walk of Fame. But Miles was inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, and I know that acceptance as a songwriter meant more to him than I think all the other gold albums that he got, was because he was able to write these songs in complete isolation or away from the world and the band, and then putting them out there and having the entire world sing them back to you, no matter where you were, was the mark of greatness. And Miles loved that idea, as you heard in that clip, that, you know, these songs are still getting played 40, 50 years later. Mm-hmm. It's just a true testament to just the catchiness and the beautifulness of rock and roll music.
And just his love, too, for, we mentioned writing, and I mean, we can talk about him as a writer, too, because he wrote not just a memoir, but he actually wrote a fictional book. He wrote a novel in 2018. But just his love of, you know, he did blues music. He had that acoustic trio that, you know, he was still performing with even as early as earlier this year. So, you know, finding that joy in other forms of music, too, but just, you know, the writing as well.
Yeah, you know, going back to Nova Scotia, like we were talking about, when he decided that he was kind of going to start putting the pieces in place for him to leave April Wine, at least in the live aspect of it, a number of years ago, one of the things that he did is he moved back to the East Coast from Montreal, and he wanted to get back to his family, wanted to get back to the down-homeness and, you know, the easy way of kind of living that the East Coast offers. And so he created an album called Miles Goodwin and Friends of the Blues that got the Juno nomination and also won the Best Blues Award album at the East Coast Music Awards. And then he put together Miles Goodwin and Friends of the Blues 2 that also won the ECMA. But it was that ability for him to continue to write made it possible for him to go back in the East Coast. And the East Coast made it palatable for him to still want to write. I think he needed to get off of that rock and roll train. I think he needed to get off of the roller coaster and continue to be creative in the world that had offered him the ability to do that, not really needing to write for money because those hits were still, you know, being played on the radio. But I think he loved writing.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote an amazing autobiography called Just Between You and Me. And that book that you mentioned, Elvis and Tiger, was really well received. So I think he could do it all.
He could. And, you know, through it all, I mean, he just seemed so, I mean, humble, just kind of down to earth, just genuine. Yeah. I mean, you know what the business can do to people or the lifestyle. But, you know, despite all those years of performing and touring, like it never seemed to change him in that way.
No. And you know what did it for him? I think getting nominated for all of those Junos, I think it was 10 or 11, and not winning, and getting into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame in 2010, and then the Walk of Fame in 2023. No knock against any of those amazing organizations. But this band was going for a very long time before that.
Yeah.
And the hits happened well before that, like most bands do. Mm-hmm. And I get it. You get to a certain age, and if you can live long enough, you start to enter into the legendary status of your career, where people start giving you lifetime achievement awards. So I get all of that. But that does something to your ego. And what it does is it puts a pin in it to make you realize that there are still people, the real people, who matter, in Miles's case, of the fans who still come out to the shows, who still go out and buy the records and listen to Spotify and watch the videos and stuff. So the industry kind of did him a little bit wrong by waiting so long, I think. And I know that Miles agrees with this because we talked about it on many occasions. So that's where the lack of ego comes from. If he would have gotten all of the awards and, you know, the big mansion and, you know, the billions of dollars, it will do anybody's head in.
Sure.
It will mess with anybody. But I think that because it came slowly and he never lost his Canadian heritage and stayed here, I think that made him more human than anybody had a right to expect from selling 10 million albums.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, you got a great write-up, as mentioned, at thatericalpert.com. Eric, you know, condolences to all of Miles' family and friends, but thanks so much for joining us here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
All the best. There you go. That's Eric Alper was Miles Goodwin's publicist. He's a music journalist and author as well. So an interesting overview of Miles Goodwin, singer-songwriter, one of the founding members of April Wine. And yeah, and I had an opportunity a few times to speak with Miles. I remember the story from 5-ish years ago where, you know, one of his prized guitars, I think it was from the 1970s, had kind of gone missing during one of the tours and tracked it down years later. Somebody had it and just, you know, getting that back and what it meant to him. Like there was that kind of genuine sense of, okay, this guy is who he seems like he is. You know, there's no big ego or, you know, the kind of rock star craziness. It's just somebody who really cares about music and writing songs and what that means to the people who consume it. It was interesting, too, in the conversation we had with him back in January, where, you know, he announced that he was kind of leaving the band or wasn't going to perform or tour with the band anymore. And, you know, there's conversations with his friends, with his bandmates about what it would mean for April Wine itself.
When I decided not to work on the road with April Wine anymore, before I announced anything, I went to Brian Greenway, who's been in the band since 1977, my right-hand guy. And I said, Brian, I said, I'm not doing this anymore. What do you want to do? Because I don't want to continue without you, and if you don't want to continue, well, that's fine with me. We'll just shut her down. But he said no. He wanted to play. He wanted to continue playing. He feels strong and excited, and wants to keep doing it. And then the other guys in the band wanted the same thing. So there were three out of four of us that was going to decide to keep going. So I said, okay, well, let's get somebody that replaces me, and we'll carry on. So that's how we, and this band is so good. And I'm not just saying that. The guy singing replaced me as singing guitar. Brian also sings leads, and so does our drummer, Roy. But his singing is, he can sound just like me. It's amazing. And he's a phenomenal guitar player and a great person. And they've bonded really well as friends and also musically. So it's a really good band right now.
The other thing we talked about at the time was, you know, what he would miss about stepping away from that. And also the question of whether there were some songs he would miss performing. And maybe there would be some songs that he wouldn't miss all that much.
I would have missed the big stages, the fans, the big audiences, the big amplifier, the big guitar, the big sound. Mm-hmm. I would have missed all of that because the only performing I'm doing right now is just an acoustic, songs and conversation kind of concerts, and they're acoustic, and I do some blues stuff after releasing a couple of blues albums that did very well. But the rock, big rock shows, I guess I'm at the end of that journey. So I'll miss that. I'll miss the friends that I know only from the road. All those people in the, all the other bands, members of the bands that I've known for years and years, we meet at airports, we meet in hotel lobbies, backstage, you know, all that jam with some of them. You know, I've known them for many, many, many years, and I won't see them again. You know, I just know that this is the end of those relationships as I've known it to be, right, in person. So, you know, that's a hard one to take.
You know, and I know when it comes to the classic hits, and these are all kind of your babies, and so maybe this is an awkward question, but are there some that over the years you were really, like, excited to perform, or there's some where it kind of felt like, oh, you know, this one again? I don't know. How did you? What's your relationship with all of them?
Well, mostly, I don't mind playing any of them. There are a couple of songs that we've done that I just do not like to do, and I try to avoid them. Because I like to have fun up there, and our set usually represents all songs that are fun. But we also have to play what the fans want.
Right.
You know, that's the same with any band, you know. And so we have to, certain songs we have to do. But there are a few of them that, you don't care for. Like Bad Side of the Moon, it might surprise people. I don't like to play that song. I like the singer play it. But people really like it, so we pull it in and out of the set. But generally, we like what we play, or we wouldn't play it.
Yeah. So you go. That was from January, a conversation we had with Miles Goodwin when he asked he was stepping away from performing and touring with the band. But it's a little surreal now because as we sort of look back and reflect on his legacy and career and the impact of the band, to sort of hear him doing the same, It certainly has a different context with news of his passing yesterday. So definitely someone will be missed, but definitely someone who will be remembered, that's for sure. I want to circle back to the conversation around primary care in Alberta. The fact that not enough Albertans have access to a family doctor, and then the trickle-down impact that has through the system. The Alberta government is taking steps to try to address that, and it sounds like more is coming in terms of a new agreement with doctors. But to fill some of the gap, the Alberta government recently announced that they will empower nurse practitioners to try to incentivize them to set up clinics and to take on patients, arguing that nurse practitioners can do most of, not all, obviously, but most of, they say, what family doctors can do. So that's one way of trying to address the problem. But what more could be done? And how does Canada stack up against other countries? There's an interesting new study published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal that takes a closer look at that. Finds that Canada lags far behind most OECD countries in terms of access to primary care, and that other countries just take a different approach when it comes to prioritizing this and devoting resources to this. So is there something Canada can take from that? Are there other experiences in other countries that maybe we could apply here? Well, joining us to talk more about some of these issues, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, one of the authors of this study, Dr. Tara Kieran, is Chair in Improvement and Innovation at the University of Toronto, Vice Chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine, also practicing in family medicine. Dr. Tara Kieran, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first of all about how Canada stacks up against other OECD countries. If we look at the metric of the number of Canadians who do not have, you know, an assigned primary care physician, what does that look like compared to some of these other countries?
Yeah, so, I mean, we knew that even before the pandemic started, we were in trouble. And now some of the latest data we have is that more than one in five adults in Canada don't have access to primary care. And contrast that to some of the other countries we looked at where, you know, more than 95% of the population has regular access to primary care. So these include countries like Norway, the Netherlands, Finland, the UK, and many others. So these countries we found, they prioritize access to primary care. They actually require or automatically register people to a primary care clinician or practice. And they actually spend more money on primary care. So really, to us, the main point for me was that they prioritize it much more than we do.
And I would assume then, maybe, does that mean they have more doctors or more primary care doctors on a per capita basis than Canada does?
Really interesting question. So we looked at that, and actually we found that the number of general practitioners or family doctors per capita was similar in Canada to many of the other countries that have more access to primary care. But what actually stood Canada apart are two things. So one is that we actually have fewer overall physicians than these other countries. And so one of those things that this brings out is that our When we're counting general practitioners and family doctors in Canada, we're actually counting people who are working in other parts of the system. And because I think we have fewer family doctors, my theory is that because we have fewer doctors overall, many of the family doctors we do have are forced to work in other parts of the system. So they end up working in emergency departments and hospitals because we just don't have the capacity among our physician group to serve those things otherwise. And so then when we're counting general practitioners, we're actually counting people who are not actually practicing family practice.
In terms of, you know, the benefits of focusing on primary care, what do these countries see then as the payoff from having that specific focus on primary care? How does that affect the rest of the system?
Yeah, it's a good question, and we need to better untangle and understand that. But I would say a few things. So for one, I think it just means that the population is better served and has a better experience of care because we know the front door of the healthcare system is primary care, and people right now in Canada are just so frustrated because they don't know where to turn. So I suspect it just means a better experience of care. But then fundamentally, I think it also translates to health. So it means people are more likely to get the preventive care they need, the chronic condition management. And there have been studies that have shown that, you know, when areas have more primary care, there are actually better health outcomes overall, lower mortality, better equity between different populations, and actually lower costs.
Right. And that's an interesting point, because even though these countries do spend more per capita on primary care, a greater percentage of healthcare spending is on primary care. Does that mean that they necessarily spend more on healthcare overall than Canada?
Yeah. So we actually didn't find that they're necessarily spending more on the total health budget. It's how they're spending the total health budget. So they're spending a greater proportion on primary care than we are. And really importantly, too, they're actually spending more of it in the public system as opposed to the private system. So Canada actually had the lowest proportion of health spending that was public among all of these nine countries. And so that means that things like, so we're thinking about things like mental health care, pharmacare, dental care, all of those things are more likely to be covered in many of these other countries. And so what happens is that the burden of managing these issues falls to family doctors. Our population isn't able to stay as well because those services are not covered. And so it stretches our workforce and causes even further access issues. So I think that's part of the equation here.
So, I mean, you know, these different countries have different healthcare systems, right? And Canada's system's different in some ways. I mean, you know, we don't have a national healthcare system, you know, like the UK does, for example. Even the relationship between family physicians and the healthcare system, that might be unique as well. So, I mean, what needs to change in Canada here?
Yeah, it's a really great point. I mean, we do have different structures. We're also really close to the United States. And so I think that changes kind of the way that we think about care. We're really close to a country that doesn't have universal access and where doctors are and prices in general are very high. So what does need to be done differently? I mean, I think we have to set the goal of 100% attachment to primary care. So that means not saying like, oh, a little bit better is okay, like 85 to 90%. We have to say that 100% of people deserve to have primary care and design our system in that way. And that would mean redesigning things. So it may mean bringing doctors more into the system. So many of them are small business owners right now and have very little accountability to where they practice their hours. And we need to do a better job bringing them into the system, organizing things like after hours care in a way that's really logical, both for patients and for clinicians. And fundamentally, we need to spend more on primary care. That means spending, for example, to increase other health professionals, changing the way doctors are paid, increasing the infrastructure so that primary care can work better. So because we see, you know, in some of these other places, for example, when you are move to the UK, you're guaranteed access to a primary care clinic that's in your neighborhood. When you grow up in Finland, you're automatically registered to a clinic. And in Norway, you're actually automatically registered to a physician. You have choice. You can actually move around if you want to, but you don't have this hassle of having to find a doctor and then not being able to. And right now in Canada, that's the number one problem. We have haves and have nots, and we really need to change that.
Right. And despite, you know, the differences, as noted, with the Canadian healthcare system, is that achievable? Could we do that here if there was the will?
I think we can, actually. I think that we have to set the goal. What I've You know, in addition to this paper that we've published today, we've been working with patients and members of the public across Canada to see what it is that they want. And everyone is unanimously in favor of this 100% guarantee of primary care. Everyone deserves it. They want to see team-based care expanded. They want to see, you know, an access to a single medical record where they can look up all their information. That's the kind of thing these other countries have as well. It increases the efficiency. So I think it's doable. And the point of this paper partly was to say, look, these other countries have done it. Yes, they have. There's some things that are different about them, but there are definitely lessons we can learn and apply here too.
Well, if anyone wants to read that paper, it's up at cmaj.ca. Dr. Kieran, thank you so much. Make some time for us here this afternoon. Really appreciate your insight on this.
Thank you for having me.
Here's a question to ponder. Do you own or have you ever considered the idea of a so-called winter beater? As our next guest writes, if ever a term belonged in a Canadian dictionary, this is it. Look, winter temperatures, winter driving can be hard on our vehicles. So the idea of having a vehicle that you just drive in the winter, knowing that it's going to get a little more beaten up than your fair weather, maybe more preferred vehicle, that there's a certain amount of logic in that to a lot of people. So that's where the idea, the concept came from. You buy a vehicle that takes the pounding and the beating in the winter, and you save maybe your better vehicle, your nicer vehicle for the nicer weather. So that's the idea. But does it actually make financial sense to have those separate vehicles? Can you make the math work? What are the pros and the cons of this approach? There's a great deep dive on all of this. You can read at driving.ca. Joining us for more, very pleased to welcome in the program here this afternoon, Brian Turner, longtime contributor at driving.ca, veteran of the automotive repair world, and the Monday morning or the Monday afternoon Motoring Monday contributor on The Drive here on QR Calgary. Brian, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
I mean, the idea of a winter beater, I mean, this is not new, obviously, but do we know how far back, I mean, where that term came from or how long that concept has been around?
Well, I think it goes back decades.
Yeah.
When the first, you know, brand new vehicle owner did not want to push their chrome shining, paint gleaming showroom purchase out into an ugly Canadian winter. And it continues. And when you look at the logic works both ways. Yes, you can say that, you know, if you buy a second car, you know, an older vehicle, maybe it's 8, 9, 10 years old, you can extend the life of the brand new one that you want to keep in pristine condition by maybe long enough to make the financial picture work. But on the other side of the coin, in most cases, you're giving up a lot of features and benefits that are designed to protect you in the worst weather. And some people will say, well, why would you risk yourself on the worst roads that Mother Nature can throw at us in a 10-year-old Toyota Corolla or Honda Civic or whatever your favorite beater is, and make it a white-knuckle drive every day?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in, you know, in the winter months, you want a reliable vehicle or even a, you know, a newer vehicle that might have some of those features, the safety features, even the features that kind of keep us warm and cozy. But, I mean, again, the point of having the winter beater is the recognition that winter driving, winter temperatures are hard on vehicles. But tell us a bit more about, you know, the impact of winter and winter driving.
Well, number one is collision risk right off the bat. We all know that every time we go out on snow-laden roads, you know, the risk of a collision, whether it be a minor fender bender or a major one, climb dramatically. We also know that for every day that your vehicle spends in a salt-laden and a water-laden and a snow-laden environment, rust will, you know, do its toll, and that's what makes it hard to find a winter beater in worthwhile condition. And I always tell people, if you're looking at buying, you know, an 8 or 9 or 10 year old vehicle, make sure you get it thoroughly inspected first. There's some corrosion you can repair, there's some cosmetic corrosion you can live with, and there's some corrosion that absolutely relegates that vehicle to the boneyard, no question about it.
Yeah, and there's the reality right now. I think there's been some improvement when it comes to vehicle affordability, but we've seen a spike in prices. So realistically, Brian, if someone's looking at a so-called winter beater, but something that provides some level of reliability, I mean, what are folks looking at?
Well, number one, look at nothing older than 10 years of age or with more than 250,000 kilometers on it. That is the quiet, unofficial time and mileage frame that most manufacturers design their vehicles to last. Doesn't mean you won't see cars on the road for 15 or 20 years because of a careful, very keen owner who's great on maintenance. Doesn't mean you won't see these vehicles relegated to the scrap heap long before that time comes up. But the 10-year, 250,000-kilometer mark is where you want to stay away from anything older or higher in mileage than that. And I also probably going to take a little heat from my friends in the four-wheel drive world. I don't necessarily recommend four-wheel drive for a winter beater because you're carrying extra cost to buy it right off the bat. If you if you're looking at a four-wheel drive versus a front-wheel drive, you're going to be paying more money. You're also going to be running more risk for maintaining all that running gear. I've always told people, and I used to have a full-time job at the Jeep plant in Brampton, Ontario, and I always tell people four-wheel drive really only gets you into trouble twice as fast and twice as far as two-wheel drive.
Is that right? You still, even if you got a winter beater, you still want to make sure, again, like, you know, as you say, some of those reliability issues. So you still want to be probably, I would imagine, looking at winter tires, right?
Absolutely, no question. You're still going to want, like, if you're buying a vehicle of in that age range, the older ones, you can expect right off the bat, if you want it to deliver safe, reliable winter transportation, you're going to be looking at, you know, a good set of winter tires. You want to have it thoroughly inspected. Probably a battery may need to be replaced, and, you know, a general check over of the engine and running gear, steering and suspension, you want to make sure is in excellent condition, because Canadian roads in the wintertime really don't do us any favors, and they're not very forgiving on vehicles that are less than perfect.
Yeah, that's for sure. I do wonder, too, I mean, you know, there is the cost of sort of having those two vehicles and, you know, you're driving one but not the other. What about the insurance there? Because I guess then you're sort of switching over your insurance, but what's the impact of doing this?
Depends on how flexible your insurance policy is. If you are going to park a vehicle for 6 or 7 months, it makes sense to talk to your insurance agent to find out what kind of impact that can have, because you're certainly not putting it at risk in a collision. And if you're storing it in a garage or a heated storage facility, they should be able to provide you some financial incentive to make the change. Keep in mind, you're also going to have to insure the vehicle you do put on the road to replace it. Winter beaters, as it was, because they have less wholesale or retail value, and in the event of a total loss, you'll find it's much cheaper to insure, for example, a $10,000 used car versus a $70,000 brand-new SUV.
Right. I mean, that part's obvious. But then if we get back to, you know, with the various safety features, like, I mean, does that factor in if an auto insurance company says, okay, I get that you've got this other newer, more expensive vehicle, but that one's probably less likely to get in a collision? Does that kind of risk assessment factor in?
Well, they are, but keep in mind, insurance companies really only look at the statistics, the bottom line. And what a lot of people are finding with all this collision mitigation, these automatic braking systems, these automatic lane assist systems, they work great in California in the summertime. But on our winter roads, these lane-keeping assist systems can't see the lane lines, can't see the dotted line if it's covered in snow.
Yeah.
Just like those collision mitigation sensors at the front of the vehicle aren't going to be worth anything when they're covered in ice and snow, just like your backup sensors in the back of the vehicle. So insurance companies, yes, they look at safety record, but they also look at the statistics. And I don't think you're going to find that when you look at the end result, let's say a long-term look at how collision mitigation has fared, it's not going to really provide a lot better assistance in winter roads.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you pointed out in your piece, I mean, for some people, it's kind of a necessity. I mean, you know, obviously, there are those who have motorcycles in the summer. Well, obviously, they need something in the winter. But, you know, people who like convertibles, they're probably going to need something in the winter. So there are some people that kind of have to do this.
Absolutely. There are a lot of vehicles that just, you know, and manufacturers will be right up front. We never designed these to be driven down the highway at minus 30 in a blizzard. So it's worth taking a look at. Fortunately, the used vehicle market is getting a little bit more relaxed during the pandemic and during the supply chain breakdowns. We all saw used vehicle prices just skyrocket. And people were driving 5- and 6-year-old vehicles back onto the dealer lot for a trade-in and getting more allowance than they paid for them originally.
Your latest, as mentioned, is up at driving.ca. Good overview of all the pros and cons of the winter beater approach. Brian, thanks so much for making some time for us here. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Safe driving, everyone.
All the best. There you go. That's Brian Turner. You know him, of course, as the Motoring Monday expert on The Drive, veteran columnist at driving.ca, and a veteran of the automotive repair world. So, yeah, I mean, you can make it work. You know, it's not necessarily for everyone, and I guess some different factors you might want to consider if you're going to take this approach. I think a lot of people buy a vehicle sort of with winter in mind. But yeah, I mean, maybe if you've got a vehicle that's better suited to summer months, maybe this kind of approach works good for you. Maybe it could make sense. Some of the text coming in, this one says, Rob, most of the people I know use their newer vehicle as their winter driver and have a 70s or an older summer sunny day cruiser. Right, that's an interesting point. So it's not necessarily a winter beater, but, you know, it's two separate vehicles, basically one for the crappy weather, one for the nice weather. Someone else says, my winter beater is a 2004 Envoy with over 430,000 kilometers. Impressive. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.